You're listening to a podcast from the RSA. You can find out more about RSA events and projects and how to get involved with the fellowship by visiting our website, thersa.org.
Hello everyone, I'm Matthew Taylor, I'm Chief Executive of the RSA. It's my great pleasure to welcome you here for this evening's special event. Michael Puett is Professor of Chinese History at Harvard and has lectured widely at the world's leading universities. In 2013, he was awarded a Harvard College professorship for excellence in undergraduate teaching. His courses have become something of a phenomenon on campus, attracting students in their thousands who come eager to hear how the works of the ancient Chinese philosophers could help set them on the path to a life well lived. Michael has recently worked with the journalist Christine Gross Lowe to distill the key elements of these teachings in a new book, The Path, A New Way to Think About Everything. I've read it over the last week, and the simple thing I'd say about it is I've just started reading it again. So much did I enjoy it, and so much did I feel at the end that there was more to get from it if I read it again. In the book, and his talk for us this evening, Michael invites us to re-examine the impact of Western philosophy on our lives and some of our deepest held assumptions, and to unlearn many ideas that inform modern society, opening ourselves up instead to the wisdom of the great scholars of the East. This can profoundly alter the way we approach our careers, our relationships, our health, our happiness. So, this promises to be a potentially life-changing hour. So, without further ado, let's get started. Please join me in welcoming Professor Michael Puett.
Thank you so much for the nice, much too nice introduction, but very deeply appreciated, and my deep thanks to all of you as well for coming. It is a very, very tremendous honor for me to be here at the Society, and a deep honor for me to have this hour to discuss these ideas with you. Thank you. Now, let me begin by saying a few words about my students, who have been forced to listen to these ideas for a bit, but I think what I'll be speaking about are more generalizable in terms of the larger topics. But first, a few words about my students. So my students grew up in what I suspect future historians will see as a distinctive era. A distinctive era that I'm kind of sorry to say, my generation bequeathed to them. They grew up in an era when kind of the big questions had been answered, right? We went through the 20th century, a period of incredible conflict and terrific wars, during which major ideologies about how to organize the world were literally at war with each other. And finally, those conflicts came to an end, and they came to an end kind of in my generation, the 89 generation. And there was a sense in my generation we had solved the big questions. We had figured out what worked, figured out how to run a society, we had figured out how to run an economy, we had figured out how human beings operate and how to grow as human beings, and we kind of thought we knew how to do things. And that next generation, the generation of my students, were very much raised in that era. And in that era, the vision runs something like the following. And my students will give variations of this, but I think they would all, at least I hope not too long into the class, but at least at the beginning of the class, they would all give a vision kind of like the following. That vision is as goes something along the following lines, which is to say they, and we, and a little bit farther back, but not too far back, live in a modern world. Luckily for us, living in this world, we've figured out the basic big questions. Among those basic big questions involves a proper understanding of the self, and very specifically what that involves is an understanding, not a view, but an understanding, a proper understanding, that each of us are unique individuals. We are unique individuals, and as such, our goal in life, if we're going to lead a flourishing life, is to look within, to find ourselves, to discover ourselves, and to love ourselves for who we are, and then to be sincere and authentic to that true self, come what may. And every time we see a difficult problem, a difficult decision, a difficult society, we always say, yes, but what is true to me? And how can I authentically live my life on my own terms? And if you do that, the assumption is, by definition, you do live your life on your terms. You decide for yourself what it is you want. And if all of us are doing this, we over time will create a great society because all of us are unique individuals supporting that vision, and each of us therefore are being encouraged to so find ourselves and live our lives on our own terms. And this is all contrasted often to what we think came before this. Before this, people lived to varying degrees in what are often called traditional societies. Societies in which, unlike us, they were told what to do. They were born into a world that had very defined social positions, and they would do things like rituals that would socialize them into playing out those proper roles. They also had a defined vision of the world, a defined understanding of the cosmos, and rituals, too, would help to socialize people into living properly within that defined vision of the cosmos. So their belief system, their social structure, their very role in life was given to them at birth, and their goal was simply to live properly within it, to accord with it, to harmonize with it. And indeed, if you want to think of the culture, the society, the civilization that most perfectly encapsulates that understanding of a traditional society, that seems indeed sort of the perfect other to, well, us, we modern people who know how to look within. The perfect other often tends stereotypically to be China, particularly old China, ancient China, where, sure enough, we tend to think they had that defined social structure. They had a pre-given vision of the cosmos. You know, it's a harmonious cosmos. And we humans are just basically doing a bunch of rituals to be socialized into living within it. And accordingly, most of my students would take something along the following lines if you ask them about, say, Chinese philosophy. They would say, well, yeah, there's one group of philosophers called Confucians, and they kind of think you should do a bunch of rituals to be socialized into playing your social roles, and they're kind of the bad guys. And then there are some good guys, they're called the Taoists, and they at least, from our perspective, have a possible way of thinking of a traditional world in a kind of more romanticized sense. So sure, they thought there was a harmonious world and you had to learn to live within it, but at least they thought that by doing so, you could harmoniously and joyously live within this larger harmony, and therefore, you would be freed from, say, the alienation that's a part and parcel of the individual lives that we lead. And so at least the Taoist would be seen as a kind of a good other. Not an other we can take too seriously, but another we can sort of, like on weekends, we can practice as we walk through a park and think, okay, I'm being nice and Taoist and enjoying the natural world. And then I go back to, you know, my real life where I have to actually do real things and know that it's not a harmonious world that I'm just living within. So my students tend to come in with basically that vision. And literally for them, it's a question during their college years, given that general vision, of in this specific time to find themselves, to look within, figure out who they are, and sort of direct their future lives accordingly. Things I'm good at, things I'm not good at, and you know, what kind of a career, what kind of a life would be good for me given who I am. My generation's idea is that they're kind of living within. Why then do they find very exciting ideas that are very different? I actually think it's for a very intriguing reason. And again, I would like to generalize it beyond just this generation, but I think it's a very specifically generational moment. I think what they are finding is that this ideology that kind of my generation bequeathed to them isn't quite working. I think all of them tend, or the vast majority, to not be too dramatic, the vast majority grow up thinking it's right. There's not a better thing out there. There are no other alternatives out there. But it doesn't seem to be quite working. The world doesn't seem to be working as well as my generation thought it would be if we just did the things that we were telling them to do. They seem to be endlessly searching for this thing, and they're not quite sure what they're finding. And I found it a generation in my 20 years of teaching that is most open to sort of rethinking everything. And I think the reason they have found these ideas from China so exciting is that they offer a fundamental challenge to almost every single assumption that I just began with. They actually start reading these texts. We read them only in their primary sources. They start reading these texts, and they suddenly see ideas that not only are utterly, totally different from the stereotypes about them, which is sort of intriguing in itself and sort of intriguing historical fact, but much more importantly, what strikes them is these are ideas that offer a very fundamental challenge to the even idea of looking within and finding oneself. In fact, it's much stronger. They actually had ideas like that in China too, and the response was from the thinkers that become very important in the tradition, these ideas not only are not liberatory, they're actually constraining and restraining what we can become as human beings. And they argued against them. And when they talked about, on the contrary, doing things like rituals, they actually had a very surprising definition of rituals, a very surprising definition of how one can grow as a human being. And I think a lot of my students are flocking to these ideas because these ideas, seem to be on to something fundamental about human psychology that perhaps we, with our very defined vision of the self, are systematically missing. And moreover, they seem to offer something very intriguing as well beyond that, which is a very concrete vision of how one would then go about leading a flourishing life if one, in a sense, kind of starts pushing past these notions of the one true authentic self. I think that's why they find these ideas exciting. Now, as I tell my students, they aren't necessarily be convinced by these ideas, although many are, but even if they're not, I think the very fact of recognizing that these ideas that my generation had bequeathed to them is a way of thinking about the self that has certain implications, perhaps some very good ones, but perhaps some dangerous ones too. That very fact opens up possibilities. And the very fact that that larger vision of history is, by definition, forced to be questioned by taking these ideas seriously also opens up tons of possibilities. And the hope for the book is to bring this to a larger audience, because I don't think this is just generational. I actually think there is a real interest now, for the first time, I think, in several decades, to really begin to rethink some of our basic assumptions. So what I would like to do for the next few minutes is to give you a sense of this, to give you a sense of what they're really arguing, very different from our stereotypes, but again, much more importantly, to give you a sense of why they're so worth taking seriously, not necessarily to agree with, but to take seriously and to allow them to challenge what we tend to take for granted. So let me begin by talking about the view of the self that becomes very important in China. And I'll forewarn you, it's going to sound bleak at first. This does not sound exciting and wonderful like this great thing that you're going to find when you look within. It's going to sound bleak at first, but bear with me because it gets very exciting very soon. But here's the bleak stuff. Is there one single individual self that we are all born with and that our goal is to look within, find, love, embrace for who we are, and then just live out our lives according to our true calling for who we really are? No. What we are is a messy bunch of stuff. A messy, messy, messy bunch of stuff. A messy bunch of stuff meaning a mess of different energies, a mess of different emotions, of desires, of dispositions, of faculties, and we're all equally messy, really messy. And what happens is we, this mess, from a very young age, we encounter other people, other messes, and we encounter them in different situations. And what happens when these messes start sort of banging up against each other is they start pulling out, dragging out these energies from each other. Literally, what they mean by this is the following. I, at whatever age this continues, but let's begin with me as a child. I, as a child, am sitting there and someone says something angrily at me, maybe for a perfectly good reason, but nonetheless, they say something angrily at me. I would say, oh, I therefore get angry. No, they would say that action draws out from me, pulls out from me. In other words, it's pulling out from me. I'm passiveness. It pulls out from me my energy of anger. I feel anger because it pulls out from me that energy. Someone else will smile at me. That pulls out from me an energy of happiness. And our lives are simply spent endlessly bumping up against other people, endlessly in situation after situation, having these energies being pulled out from us, leading us to feel happy, sad, joyous, angry, resentful, all of these things, moment by moment. And if that doesn't sound bleak enough, namely that we're totally passive in this, it gets much worse. Much. Because at least there, I'm really responding to what's happening, even if only passively. Just as I'm being pulled moment by moment. But it turns out, actually, the way we work, again, from a very young age, is as we're being pulled out all the time, we fall into kind of patterns of these responses, ruts of responses. And so, yeah, to go to my example where this person says something that makes me angry, then someone else can say something perfectly nice, but for whatever reason, it reminds me, or sort of, to put it in their terminology, pulls out from me a comparable kind of response. You know, may look like the person who said something angrily to me, or the tone of voice may sound similar, even though with totally different intent. Irrelevant. The point is, it pulls out from me that same response. And over time, we fall into these patterns that can just be repeated endlessly. And when you wonder, why is it that, for example, when I look within and decide I'm just the sort of person who, you know, gets angry at little things, well, their answer is, you're the sort of person who gets angry at little things because that's the pattern of responses you've fallen into. Little things happen, it draws out anger from you. Other things happen, it draws out happiness. And these are just these patterns we fall into. These patterns, these ruts, are what we, therefore mistakenly from this point of view, call a personality. They also, by the way, are what we would find if we look within. Because when you look within and find out who you really are, I'm just the sort of person who does X, Y, and Z, but I'm the sort of person who does these other things, according to this view, what you're finding are just these ruts that you've fallen into. And they would say, the last thing in the world you want to do is to embrace and love these ruts. The last thing you want to do. These ruts are devastating to you. They're devastating to those around you. And they can repeat for months, years, decades. They can literally determine your life. They do become your calling, but not in a good way. You passively just play out these ruts. And they can go on for generations. Generations. So the patterns that play out, say, with parents and their children, those children grow up and tend to play out the exact same patterns with the next generation, and they can go on and on. So it's not just dominating your life. It's not even just dominating the lives of those who actually interact with you. It can dominate two generations down of people that you would otherwise never even meet. But boy, your patterns sure dominate their lives. That's what human beings are like. So the last thing you want to do is embrace and love this set of stuff, these patterns and ruts you've fallen into. What you want to do is break them. You want to break the patterns, but you want to do something else too. You don't only want to break these ruts, although you most certainly want to. You want to actually slowly train yourself to not be so dangerously rutted and so dangerously patterned. Your goal is to train yourself to be able to literally begin to respond to the world, to respond well to the world, even to begin to respond to the world in ways that allow you to work with this messy world that we're in, to be able to actually act in ways to bring out better responses from those around you, to slowly become a better person because if everything is interactions and relationships, you work with those interactions and relationships, and you begin to create worlds within you, a messy bunch of stuff, and others, messy bunches of stuffs, can begin to flourish together. Now, that might sound very abstract. I mean, sure, that's great to think we can flourish together, but I mean, how would we get there, especially if they're right that we're just a bunch of messes? Well, here's where we get rituals. Rituals for them are almost the pure opposite of how we tend to think of rituals. We, again, tend to think of rituals kind of negatively because rituals tell us what to do, which means we have to be inauthentic because we're doing something that's not us. Or if we think of them positively, it's the sort of thing, yeah, we do like holiday rituals and the fun rituals, but we don't really have to do those, so it's they're just fun. Well, the vision of ritual that develops in China, on the contrary, holds, yeah, you have to really do them, so we don't get the easy out as we get with the holiday rituals, but you don't do them in the sense that we tend to think about them. What they will argue is think of rituals, but more importantly, enact rituals, as kind of mini as-if worlds, where for a brief moment, you become a different person, in their sense of that word. You, for a brief moment, become a different person interacting with those around you in a different way. And by doing that, you break the normal patterns that tend to dominate your life. A very concrete example from their world before I turn to our own. So I mentioned these generational problems that can just be repeated endlessly. What's one of the rituals they would practice? So let's talk about father-son relations all the way down. I, by the way, had a wonderful father and have a great relationship with him, so I'm not speaking from personal experience, but nonetheless, historically, there can be problems in these generations. If that's the case, and they certainly thought there could be, what they would do is the following. Suppose you're the father, and your father has passed away, and you have a son. So grandfather, father, son. Father and son living, the grandfather's passed away. The ritual involves the son going into a ritual space and playing the role of his grandfather. Therefore, he is acting as the father of his own father because his own father has to play the son to his deceased father, who is now being acted by his son, and so the father has to play the role of being a son to his own son, and the son plays the role of being the father to his own father, and the idea is those three generations are being, through a role reversal, forced to see the world from the other perspective. The grandfather may not be involved, obviously, but the son and father are forced to. The son from an early age learns what it means to be the father, the one in a position of authority, and all the responsibility that comes from that, as well as the dangerous feelings of sort of arrogance that can come from that. The father has to relearn what it is like to be in the subordinate position, and he has to do it with his own son. And the idea is you enter this ritual, you're forced to do the role reversal, you're forced to have this break in the pattern that usually dominates the two when they're outside of the ritual, and it's the break that matters. Now, if that's what they mean by ritual, let's jump immediately to our lives. Now, you might say, well, for better or for worse, we don't do rituals because, again, we tend to think of them as inauthentic things. So even if they're worth doing, well, we don't have them. We certainly don't do role reversal rituals. Well, actually, we do. Here's what's intriguing. When they were making these arguments, they weren't living in a world that was doing rituals like this. They were arguing they needed to be done like this. What they were actually saying is, among these ruts and patterns that dominate our lives are endless social conventions. The endless ways in which we talk to someone using one tone of voice as opposed to another. The endless ways that we will hold our body one way in a certain situation and another way in another situation. We do these all the time. We don't think about them. We do them by rote. They are among the different patterns that we are simply playing out. Some are based on our emotions, others are social conventions, and most of what we do is a kind of a combination of all of those. The goal, they would say, is you take these conventions and you make them into rituals. You actually take these little conventions you do, and you really do them. You really do them in the sense that for that brief moment, you break from the normal patterns, and for that brief moment, you become a different person interacting with those around you in a different way. If, for example, you're walking down the street, things are going miserably, you're anxious, you're concerned, angry, blah, 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 and you see a friend, you don't say, oh, how are things going, and you go through and say how miserable both of you are. You do the little convention, but they would say do it as a ritual. You break from that for a moment. You say, hey, how's it going? And the other person goes, oh, pretty good. How are you? And says, oh, I'm doing great, too. Great to see you. And then you go on. If you really do it, in other words, it's not a rote convention, but if you do it as a ritual, you break from what you had been just doing, the usual patterns dominating you as you're experiencing the world, and you break. And for that brief moment, that mundane microsecond, you're a different person connecting with another human being and really connecting with that human being. And then you don't again. You're not being inauthentic. You really are connecting, but you're doing it in the way that the father, son, and grandfather are doing it in that other ritual. They're not, the son isn't really the grandfather, but you really develop the emotions of what it would be to be that. And their argument is, you do rituals not because they socialize you into a proper vision of the world. As you can see now, they're kind of the opposite. You do rituals because they break you from your patterns. That's why you do rituals. And where does this take you? Their argument is, you start doing this. You start, as they would say, training yourself through these rituals. And what you're really doing by training yourself through these rituals is, over time, you're beginning to gain a sense of the messiness of the world and the degree to which we're patterned. You begin to gain a sense of the little things that you do that are affecting other people, usually without us knowing because they're ruts. And you begin to work with those. You begin to sense the degrees to which most of our relationships, hopefully some good ones, but a lot of them are pretty bad for this very reason, are based in these dangerous patterns. And you begin to realize how malleable they are because you begin to start shifting with them. You begin to start acting slightly differently. When someone does something in a relationship, like the same old standard pattern plays out, that person says something, it makes you angry, it makes that person angry, and the whole thing degenerates into the usual evening fight, you do something slightly different. They would say, you're making it into a ritual. Not self-conscious, you're not saying, okay, let's do a ritual now. You just do something slightly different. And it will unconsciously bring out some kind of a different response, and then you do something else still. And slowly what you're training yourself to do is recognize that we don't have single selves, nor does anyone. None of us has a single authentic self. We're all messy creatures with dangerous patterns, and you're working with those. And where does this ultimately take you? Here's an example. Confucius, the figure I mentioned earlier, often seen as this, you know, person who just says, do rituals all the time. Well, he did say that. But the reason he said do that is because, as he is described, whether this is historically accurate or not is irrelevant, but as how he's described is as someone who had done this. And by the end of his life, he is described as someone who is so good at this that he is simply able, in any situation, incredibly mundane, you're to see some disciples, or huge in terms of societal problems, that he would, in that situation, sense all the dangerous patterns and ruts that were defining people's relationships and simply do things that would shift those. That he would be able to simply, in those mundane situations, use a tone of voice or act in a certain way or quote a line of poetry that had certain resonances that would bring out different responses from those around him, breaking the patterns that was dominating them, and for that brief moment, people would be able to connect. And he'd create these worlds where people could flourish. And then the idea was, at a larger social level, he was doing the exact same thing. Same thing. Sensing these larger patterns that are destroying us without us even knowing it, and acting in ways, doing things, writing texts in this case, doing things that will shift those patterns for the better. The goal being to create these worlds within which we can flourish. Or to put it in stronger terms, the worlds we live in are created by us, usually through our ruts and patterns, that we have fallen into passively, take them seriously, work with them, you on the contrary create worlds within which people can flourish. Note the ultimate irony, therefore, of our way of thinking about these ideas and, from the flip side, what we can learn from them. If we take our own definition of a traditional society seriously, a society, as I mentioned at the beginning, in which we are pre-given who we are, that pre-givenness, the roles we play in life, is also something that is pre-given in terms of a vision of a stable self that we have to be and a stable world that we have to fit within. By that definition, ironically, we are the ones that are actually creating a traditional society by our vision of the one unique self that we should simply love, embrace, decide it's who we are, and think of as our true calling to play out, as they would say, our patterns endlessly, and how you break from this, well, there are many ways of doing it, but they would say the way you break from it is not our vision of a modern world, which is the problem from this point of view, the way you break from it is to recognize the degree to which this is how human psychology operates, and you self-consciously begin to work with these patterns, break them, shift worlds, not to train people to live within something defined, but to open up possibilities where you create worlds within humans, within which humans can flourish. The key being, however, in advance, there's no way of knowing what that's going to be, and so it's endless work. Or, putting it in a final twist, kind of the world that my generation bequeathed to them is a world in which they were being defined by very, we now would say in retrospect, dangerous patterns that were not even seen as such. And perhaps part of the interest now is to recognize we think all of this, and suddenly everything is up for grabs. What types of a world we build? Perhaps we haven't decided, answered the big questions at all. How to think of the past? Perhaps we've thought about it perfectly incorrectly. And how to therefore learn from the past and rethink the future by questioning so many of these assumptions that we simply have taken for granted. And if that is why I think that generation finds these ideas so exciting, I would like to generalize it by simply saying, I think perhaps we're at a moment when people are ready to rethink these ideas that have so dominated us for the past few decades, and perhaps recognize that other visions of the self could be taken seriously, and if they are, they open up possibilities that we didn't even realize didn't exist. It's that we thought we didn't have to worry about because, again, we thought we had figured out everything and solved all the big problems. Maybe we were wrong, and maybe there are worlds we really could start creating through our very basic ways of being in the world. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Michael. It's fascinating. I want to start by something which you didn't refer to at all in your talk, but I can't resist it because of where we are. This painting,
yes,
is a kind of classic representation of a view of the Enlightenment, which is when it was painted by James Barry. And so in this painting, really, what happens is there's the ancient world, the Olympics.
Indeed.
And then, basically, there's the Enlightenment. We kind of lose our way.
Yes.
The Roman Empire falls. We go into a deep, dark place.
Absolutely.
Then we rediscover,
yes,
the ancient Western world, and everything's fine. That's basically nonsense, isn't it?
I think it's total nonsense. And yeah, and I think you're right. I mean, the vision underlying this is it was a traditional world. We had brief moments where what would ultimately become modernity flourished. Greece, then it's lost again. Renaissance, lost again for a bit. Enlightenment, and then finally the modern world is created. And this nice vision, based upon traditional modernity divisions, assumes the modern world as we now perceive it is right, and it's just who had it moments before. And of course, completely absent from this, as you said, is anything outside the West. No ideas are worth taking seriously, because presumably those are all traditional, and they never had the blips toward modernity, and therefore don't need to be taken seriously at all, or even portrayed.
But you argue that actually many Enlightenment thinkers were strongly influenced by ideas that had come from the East.
Absolutely. I mean, this is our vision looking backwards. They themselves wouldn't have bought this, and your example is a perfect one. In the Enlightenment, what were they looking at? Well, I'll give you one simple example, Voltaire. Voltaire was looking at China, and he and many of the other figures he was working with were saying these ideas because they were just getting for the first time, beginning only in the 17th century and then being widely read in the 18th, these discussions from the Jesuits of what life was like in China, and the Jesuits then began actually translating these works, and people like Voltaire said, you know, we too can build a society that's based upon meritocracy, where an educated elite is encouraging the younger to become educated as well. And we try to through training and education, create a better world. He correctly said, that's what they're doing in China. And hey, maybe we could even do it here in Europe. Isn't that amazing? And this is all now forgotten.
Where does the idea of consciousness figure in these ideas?
Yes.
So consciousness, as we all know, is an incredibly elusive,
very
difficult idea. I was sum this up by the phrase people use all the time, I said to myself.
Yes.
So who exactly is having that conversation?
Yes. Yes.
Where do these thinkers, and of course you talk about a lot of thinkers, so you're generalizing
yes.
here, but where do they stand on this issue of consciousness? Is there a kind of, you talk about people being rotted, are they appealing
yes.
to an unrotted me that is somehow behind all the rots?
Intriguingly, no. So oftentimes we think, well, even if we admit there are a bunch of ruts, at least there is this me someplace, that the spirit in the machine, the ghost in the machine, the real me, the real soul that's beyond all of this. They would say it's all energies and relationships all the way up and all the way down. Now, consciousness, therefore, is incredibly highly, highly, highly refined energies. It's what allows us to the limited degrees that we can when we're untrained to do things. I can move this cup if I choose to. I can think thoughts. I have what we call consciousness. But they would say only to a very limited degree. Were we to be training ourselves, gaining an ability to be highly resonant with the world, therefore highly able to alter and work with the world by sensing the degree in which it's a messy one and therefore a malleable one, the degree to which we're doing that, we're developing what we would call more consciousness. But of course, from their point of view, what you're really developing is an ability to endlessly work with the complexities of these relationships. And thinking, from that point of view, from this way of thinking, is deeply patterned. We don't really think the way we could. If we did, what we would be able to think would be incomparably more complex and resonant with what's really going on, because we would be training ourselves to be able to do so.
Now, one of the traps of the book, because it's about trying to understand people who lived in a different time, had a different perspective, is that you think, oh, that's that.
Yes.
And there's two things that, as I was reading, I thought, oh, yeah. Does he mean this? And is it? So I just want you to
yes.
So at certain points, this is mindfulness, isn't it? This is just a kind of clever type of mindfulness that you're describing here. And at other times I thought, oh, this is cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, which is also about kind of unlearning neural pathways and avoiding kind of
yes.
repetitive behaviors that are destructive. Is it?
In your way of beginning the question is perfect. It seems this, but maybe not. And I would say imperfectly with these examples too. In some degree, yes, in some degrees, no. So first, mindfulness. When mindfulness was developed, the concerns were very similar to the ones we're talking about here. But the way mindfulness has been appropriated and domesticated, certainly in America, I suspect probably less so in Britain, but certainly in America, that view has basically been one of self-acceptance. And so you do mindfulness techniques to learn to be accepting of who you really are. And so, yes, if I get angry at little things, I do mindfulness techniques so I'm not bothered by the fact that I get angry at little things. which, from this point of view, is, again, the last thing you want to be doing. The last thing you want to do is be more comfortable in your ruts, more able to not let your ruts bother you and love yourself all the more for them. These figures would say, well, no, what you want to do is change them and alter them and break them. So in that sense, it is radically different from the kind of mindfulness practices, at least as they've been developed recently, and particularly, I would say, in America.
And cognitive and behavioral therapy?
And there, too, in some ways very, very similar, because cognitive behavioral therapy, as you said, is all based upon a notion, they use a slightly different terminology, but a very similar point, that we have these patterns and you're trying in practice to alter them. And here I would say the visions we're talking about work perfectly with them, but they're more expansive. I mean, imagine a vision of cognitive therapy that took it to the next level and said, well, we're relationships all the way down. There is no real true self that you're trying to sort of free by the therapy. It's all mess. It's all relationships. It's a very scary thought, but then the flip side of that is an incredibly opening thought when you actually begin to work through what this would mean in practice.
Reading the book, you might think, well, this is great, and you give these texts to your students, and they're old texts, and you're interpreting them, and but that's kind of ancient history. But what is fascinating, as I understand it, is that new texts are emerging
yes.
in China, amazing new texts, which are leading to quite fundamental questioning of these ideas. Just tell it, that must be so exciting for
us. Unbelievable. We are in a period where literally our entire corpus is not only growing dramatically, but it's forcing us to rethink everything we thought. So these stereotypes I began the talk with, they've also dominated the scholarly world, I'm embarrassed to say, and scholars have been reading the texts accordingly. And these new texts we're discovering, they were actually found in tombs and are being discovered in tombs. And so you would put things associated with a person when they passed away in the tomb. And so now we're discovering entire libraries that would be buried in tombs. And they are forcing a complete rethinking of what we used to understand about Chinese thought. It's these ideas we've been discussing tonight. And so as these ideas are coming to life again, they also, in a very literal sense, being excavated anew, and that is part of what is forcing this rethinking of what we thought we knew about the Chinese tradition.
Some of it's quite political, isn't it? I mean, I know it was reading that one of these texts undermines the kind of notion that Confucian thought is basically deferential to leaders, even if they're not very good leaders, and says, no, actually, if the leader's not very good, the leader ought to move aside, which, as a text in modern China, must be quite a kind of explosive.
Extremely. I mean, these are politically hot texts because these ideas are being debated again in China, they're being taken seriously again, and these newly excavated texts are forcing the kind of rethinking we've been discussing, and they break many patterned ways of thinking, to say the least. That's part of why they're so exciting and potentially very, very subversive.
Thank you. Right, there's a gentleman there and there's a gentleman there. If you don't mind, we'll take them in three.
Of course, okay? Absolutely.
Michael, fascinating talk. Like you, I've lived half my life in the East and half my life in the West.
Wonderful.
There is something fundamentally different between the East and the West. We're both human beings, but we're different. And when I listen to you, what I hear is the word empathy.
Yes.
Now, my thought here, listening to you, is, are you pushing at a closed door? Is it your students may be very excited, but are we, as Westerners, simply lack that empathy which you see in the East? And don't think I'm sentimentalizing the East, because I've lived there too long. I know there's pluses and minuses. But I'm just curious to know whether you think you can read about this, but we basically don't have as much empathy, and that has big ramifications when you talk about things like climate change and all sorts of stuff about trying to think about the future. Any thoughts on that?
Thank you very much for that talk. It was very refreshing to find somebody arguing so articulately against complacency. But I'm just wondering whether, sitting here as an epitome of the Western man, would Socrates be forgiven for feeling a sense of deja vu?
Yes.
Didn't he say the unexamined life is not worth living? So hasn't it been said before?
Yes.
Yeah, connected with that, I just wondered what your thoughts are on what I see as the setup for business, commerce, and how, you know, advertising, etc., the consumer society, how, if this catches on, how would they respond, and what are the implications for that? We want our new phone, that seems to make us happy, it's about us, and
yes.
How does that fit, and if it does catch on. Is business going to have to rethink things?
Okay, so empathy.
Yes, indeed.
Did the Greeks get there at the same time?
Indeed.
And is this the end of consumer capitalism?
Yes, indeed. All three outstanding questions, and even though they're randomly chosen, they fit perfectly well with each other. So I'll answer them together. The intriguing thing is, and I'll actually sort of begin slightly with the middle one and then pull the rest together from there. One of the intriguing things I find about doing comparative philosophy is I went in thinking, okay, there are sets of assumptions in one culture and they're going to be radically different in another culture. So very exciting, but also means we can't really learn that much from each other because they're just totally different. And what I find in practice is exactly what you've just expressed. I find in practice that great ideas emerge over and over and over again in world history. And then what's particularly intriguing about philosophical traditions and larger cultures is, for very intriguing historical reasons, some take off in some places and some kind of don't. And so none of the ideas that we associate with being uniquely modern are uniquely modern. They've all appeared all over the place, including in China. And I would put it a very strong term the other way, too. I think none of the ideas we're talking about in China can't be found elsewhere. They certainly have appeared in various forms in the Western tradition. But oftentimes the ones have been kind of shunted aside. Whereas the ideas that we take so for granted were not only shunted aside, they were actively rejected in significant parts of the Chinese tradition. So part of, I think, why we do comparative philosophy is we can learn from sort of roads not taken in various traditions that can then allow us to rethink them and take them seriously again. And could we do much the same that we're talking about here by pulling on different strands of Western thinking too? Absolutely. But since now we can think in a much broader sense, as earlier Enlightenment figures were as well, it gives us all the more power to work with ideas as they were developed for centuries in certain cultures that really took them seriously. And that plays on directly the earlier question, too, about empathy. Yes. Now, the way I would put it, however, is, as someone who thinks that these Chinese thinkers are onto something about human psychology, I would say that's probably empirically true now, but we're malleable creatures. And if we have fallen into patterns that restrict our empathy because we're so taken with the notion of the individual self, I think those are changeable and alterable. And I think we are every bit as capable in any culture of becoming as empathetic as everyone else. It's just that we've fallen into ruts in which we are not, and therefore not empathetic toward others, not empathetic toward the larger world that we are very quickly destroying. But I think that's all changeable. And touches directly on the third question, too, which fits in perfectly. Yes. So I think everyone should take these ideas seriously. I think that they offer a fundamentally, I'll use a strong word, correct understanding of human psychology. A lot of contemporary psychological experiments actually are showing the degree to which they are correct. And the nice thing, however, is if one worries, well, if some people really took these ideas seriously, wouldn't it allow them to have a lot of power over us? Yes. But if lots of people take them seriously, it means they won't, because you cease to be so passively taken by them. So yes, I think business practices, government practices, but also non-government practices all need to be rethought, because I do think humans work this way, and take it seriously, the world is much more malleable in both a dangerous but a very exciting sense, and they're flip sides of the same coin, which means we need to be actively working to create good worlds as opposed to very, very dangerous worlds. So thank you to all three questions. Wonderful.
Thank you very much. This was really interesting. And I would love to know, what is the number one career advice that you give to your students?
Yes. Great question. And what I tell them is, don't do what almost every college counselor is telling you to do. I mean this in the following sense. Most college counselors will give advice along the following lines. So number one, again, find yourself. And once you find yourself during this brief period and you decide who you really are, your career should then be based on that. So think of who you are, your great sides, but your weaknesses. So what are your gifts, your talents, but what are the things you aren't so good at? And then gear your career in this form of saying, what am I good at, and how can I, being who I am with what I love and with what I'm good at, fit into this world out there? Assuming, obviously with great intent, but nonetheless assuming, a stable self and a stable world. And as I tell my students, assume the precise opposite. You are a very messy bunch of stuff. Empirically, right now, you may be really good at this and really bad at this. You may love this and hate this. Those are just ruts. And the world where you think that would fit in well is going to be changing dramatically anyway. And so I say, do the exact opposite. Actively start training yourself. Actively start doing things you think you're not good at. Actively start doing activities that seem just potentially interesting, but not to at all fit into your defined vision of who you are. And those practices will start changing you. And as you become more open to these possibilities and shifting who you are, you will suddenly find that avenues that had otherwise been closed off because of this defined vision of who you are in your future start opening up. And great career options are going to come out of that kind of work, not out of the work of finding yourself and gearing a life based upon your strengths. Now, that may seem like really idealistic advice, but let me say, students who really start doing this find, on the contrary, it's incredibly opening to them, that otherwise they feel they're spending their 3 to 4 years in college on an endless quest to find this one thing that they can't find, and they end up choosing a career kind of by default, or I would say by following out patterns and ruts, and otherwise, they start opening up themselves to incredible career options. And you know, having now worked with students 20 years down the road, they're doing unbelievable things. So that is what I would recommend.
Hi, yeah, it'd be interesting to hear your thoughts on how to take it beyond the kind of theory and the concept and to put it into practice. For example, a lot of us feel uncomfortable with uncertainty.
Yes.
And we try to fix things which are unfixable. And I think that is part of the challenge and the anxiety that builds up in a person.
to actually grasp that actually there is lots of things that can happen and can't happen. And I think, how do you then begin to put that into practice where you can actually take it beyond, okay, this is really great, I feel really passionate about this, but how do I actually implement it in a daily basis into my life, into my thinking?
In contrast to the malleability which you think we should adopt, is the role of individual genius. Confucius was a genius, Aristotle's a genius. So how does individual genius, that to us seems to be defined by utter brilliance in certain fields, unless you're Aristotle, who was good at everything, how does that fit into this picture?
Yes.
Hi, thank you. This is still halfway formulating my question, but it's something along the lines of, I recently heard a talk by Yuval Harari, who's a historian, and with my background in technology, and his most recent talk was looking at the history of ideologies over mankind and saying that we're moving away from religions and the individual power to basically hand over to technology, which will actually, rather than looking inwards and using intuition inbuilt from generations in the genes, looking at the way that we're collecting so much data now. And the question is actually, where does that sit with you? How would you kind of relate to this topic of perhaps in our current modern world, a lot of answers can be given to us from the statistics with such massive data collection, and do you have a comment on that?
Yes. All three wonderful questions, and again, perfectly fit together. So I'll begin with the latter one and then move backwards from there. So beginning with the latter, again, taking these ideas seriously, I would say technologies aren't necessarily the driving force that we tend to think they are. The reason I say that is I think these patterns and ruts are what really drive us. And when new technologies are developed, we tend to kind of fit them into our patterns and ruts and just continue playing life as usual. And so when we see technologies taking us in dangerous directions, I love to think, isn't it really our lifestyle that's taking us in dangerous directions, and we're just using technologies in ways that we couldn't before because we can do more of it, and that's why it's dangerous, but it's the patterns that are at risk. So I would say, in terms of the way we're using technologies right now, are they destroying the globe? Are they leading us to think of ourselves as robots? Are we becoming too data-driven because we think everything can be quantified? I would say, no, those are our patterns, and we're just able to do it better now. We're able to more quickly destroy the world than we used to be able to do. The flip side of that, and hopefully the optimistic side, is to say, hopefully that will scare us into breaking some of these patterns. And hopefully that will scare us in a way that will allow us to use these technologies in good ways. Because I don't think technologies are the problem. I think technologies can be incredibly wonderful, amazing things. It's just how we use them. And how we're using them now is extraordinarily dangerous. We could, on the contrary, use these great technologies as well as others we couldn't imagine in stunning, extraordinary ways. And I would say that's true across the board. The creation of agriculture wasn't the problem. The creation of computers isn't the problem. The creation of database thinking isn't the problem. It's what we've done with this that can be incredibly dangerous, or, in every single one of those examples, unbelievably opening as well. So, yes, wonderful question. And intriguingly, directly related to the genius question, again, I take these ideas seriously, so to push them as far as we can, to try to take them as seriously as we can, I would say maybe or maybe not. And what I mean by that is maybe genius, as we define it, when we think of the sole great individual genius, maybe that we're talking about people who became unbelievably, stunningly good at certain things, but not because they were born with a unique gift that the rest of us don't have. It's because they took this messy stuff that they were and were able to develop certain aspects at levels that for whatever reason, the others of us haven't done. Now, in saying that, do I think every single person in this room could be an Einstein or a Mozart? No, that isn't necessarily the claim. But the claim is to say, what if we think of genius as based in these endless relationships as well, which means all of us are potentially capable of doing things we could not otherwise imagine. And it's always, therefore, from that point of view, dangerous to say they could do things we can't ever do because they were just born with it. And they like to push this to the extreme, and I'll play the game, therefore, as well, of saying, let's at least think as if they're right, and we're all equally messy, but therefore equally capable of doing extraordinary things. And the reason most of us don't is because we live our lives by these patterns and these ruts. Now, is that going to prove to be objectively correct? I have no idea, but since we have no idea, It's a nice as-if world to think about, because then we're no longer restricting ourselves. And if we're at least thinking we're capable of doing things we couldn't imagine we were doing, that's likely going to allow us to do things we could otherwise never have done. And that leads actually perfectly to the final question, the first of the three, but I'll use it to close this discussion, of the three in general. What this would mean in practice would be to say, yes, it is a capricious, messy world, which is a very scary thought. But the flip side of that, if it's really malleable, then much of our frustration when we want something to happen and it simply doesn't happen, the answer to the question would be, it's the daily work. It's the daily training. The way I felt like to think of this is, you know, think of learning a musical instrument that takes years and years and years of work to just, you know, do these drill patterns over and over again, but there with a specific purpose, which is you're gaining an ability to sense situations, sense music, sense how you can feel a room, sense how you can shift the atmosphere and feeling of the room by the way you play. These are skill-based activities that all of us do probably at some level. We've learned a musical instrument, we've done a sport, we've done some skill-based activity. And in a sense, what they're saying is, think of your daily mundane life as the same thing. We know we're capable of doing this because we've all done skill-based work in which we have so trained ourselves, but we just don't think of our daily lives this way. But think of what would happen if you did. And getting back to the key of your question, will that solve the particular problem you're dealing with? Maybe or maybe not, but what it does do is it opens up again, referring back to the earlier questions too, possibilities you otherwise couldn't imagine. Who would imagine you could play stunning music after 20 years of work? Well, imagine what we can be if we're doing that same kind of training that we know we're capable of doing on our daily life. And they would say, things that seem to be insoluble change dramatically because, in a sense, either you solve them directly, but more importantly, you may create worlds in which the problems are simply shifted to something radically different. And that comes out of the daily work. So they would say it's doable and very practical. It's just oddly, we reserve that kind of training for specific limited exercises. Imagine what we could do if we devoted our life to this.
So you need to read this book twice. But, and this is the kind of insight that I've got now, you can't read it twice unless you read it the first time. And if you want to read it the first time, then you need to buy it outside, and then Michael will sign it for you, and it will be a treasured possession when he has done so. You've asked some fantastic questions. It's been a wonderful hour that we've spent together. It just reminds me to ask you to join me in thanking our wonderful speaker, Michael Pewart.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not download our free app to access video and audio files on the go? Just visit our website, thersa.org, and follow the links to the RSA Vision mobile app.